the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, update on metastatic breast cancer from the 33rd Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And I know many of you living with metastatic disease have waited for today's program, and so we have lots of information for you today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call. We have on the call today over 737 participants on the call, so there are a lot of you on the call, and you come from all regions of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Italy, Pakistan, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call. You really are from all over the world. You have received information from Cancer Care, and I would like you all to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form that's in your materials. We very much appreciate your feedback. You know, this is the beginning of a new year, and indeed, today's program was one that many of you have requested that we offer. And so your recommendations, we take them very seriously. And so tell us what you'd like us to do, and we'll try very hard to implement those educational programs. Today's program was made possible with support from AZI Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. We have wonderful speakers today on our program, just really the best of the best. And our very first speaker today is Dr. Julie Grala. Dr. Grala is Professor of Medical Oncology, Director of Breast Medical Oncology, University of Washington School of Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, Associate Member, Clinical Research Division, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Grala is going to address endocrine therapies, and she's going to give a bit of an overview also on metastatic disease. Dr. Grala?
Thanks so much, Carolyn, and thanks to everyone who is on the call and listening. We've been tasked with talking a little bit about what's new in metastatic breast cancer and what happened at the 33 annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium that was held in December of last year. So to start out, when we think about breast cancer now, I think many of you are aware that we're not just talking about one type of cancer. There are lots of subtypes that are developing, and more our treatments are based on subsets of breast cancer. Right now, what we're mainly using to subset breast cancer in either the metastatic or early stage setting are estrogen receptor and progesterone receptor and HER2. And these are measured on all breast cancers, and we kind of say positive or negative, and sometimes they're intermediate. But we subset breast cancer based on expression of hormone receptors, such as estrogen and progesterone receptor, and HER2. And so there's also that group that we currently are calling triple negative because they don't express any of these three receptors. So I'm going to start by talking about what's new with ER-positive or hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. Then Eric will talk a bit about HER2-positive, and Lisa will talk a bit about the triple negatives. So at the San Antonio meeting specifically, there wasn't a whole lot in the metastatic breast cancer setting in endocrine therapy, but I want to talk about a few things that came out, some of them even in earlier stage studies, but that are important for women who are dealing with recurrent breast cancer. We saw a trial report called the MA27 trial. It was a very large 8,000 almost patient trial that was run by NCI Canada, but North America in general participated, and it was a head-on comparison between two different aromatase inhibitors. You probably know that there are three different ones, anastrozole, which is Arimidex, exemestane, which is aromacin, and letrozole, which is Femara, and they all act in very similar ways. So this trial asked the question, is there a difference between anastrozole or Arimidex and exemestane or aromacin? And what we saw reported was there wasn't a difference with respect to the breast cancer recurring. And what we're really interested in is is there a difference in the side effects of these drugs? And that we don't have a whole lot of data on, but what we saw was there was no difference between these two aromatase inhibitors, at least in an earlier stage breast cancer setting. Now, what's interesting is that just in the last few months, one of the three aromatase inhibitors, anastrozole or arimidex, went off patent. So right now, it is considerably cheaper than the other three. And I think that this trial is one of several pieces of evidence that suggests that if there's really no obvious major difference between the aromatase inhibitors, right now what I'm writing for is the anastrozole or arimidex because I don't see a difference between the three, and it's much cheaper. So that was one interesting presentation at San Antonio. Another couple of presentations that are really important to endocrine treatment, especially in the premenopausal population, is what is the best way to predict who's going to respond to tamoxifen. Tamoxifen is still a great anti-estrogen drug. We can't forget about that. And it's really our main drug that's approved in the premenopausal setting for ER-positive breast cancer. And you may have heard that there have been some studies that have looked at our own body's metabolism of tamoxifen. Tamoxifen in and of itself isn't really an active drug in fighting breast cancer. We need to metabolize it through our own inherited enzymes to convert it to an active form. And one of the main enzymes that does this conversion is called CYP2D6. And we actually have a test for what is our inherited kind of rate of this enzyme and its ability to metabolize tamoxifen. So some early studies suggested that in about the 7% of the population that is inherited kind of a low metabolism, and maybe in an additional 15% of the population that has an intermediate metabolism of tamoxifen, maybe that's not the best drug. Now, so we saw the presentation of two big studies of tamoxifen in breast cancer that looked at this CYP2D6, our own inherited enzymes, and did that in fact impact response to tamoxifen recurrences and outcome. And in both of these big studies, the B198 study and the ATAC study, studies of tamoxifen versus an aromatase inhibitor, CYP2D6 and our own inherited metabolism didn't predict for benefit or not from tamoxifen. So at the present time, we're not recommending that we test CYP2D6 to decide who should get tamoxifen or something else, and we think that further studies are needed. So this was kind of important data that we shouldn't be testing the CYP2D6 in women that we want to use tamoxifen in. Now, a lot of women with recurrent or metastatic breast cancer that is ER or estrogen receptor positive respond well for a period of time to a therapy, and then the tumor starts growing again. And a big question has been, can we overcome that resistance to endocrine therapy so that we can have longer response? We're looking at all kinds of cool drugs, new biologics, that might be able to impact this. One study that was presented called the TAMRAD study looked at a drug in the class called an mTOR inhibitor. And we know that the estrogen pathway, the mTOR pathway, they interact, and that one mechanism of resistance, for example, to either aromatase inhibitors or tamoxifen might involve this other pathway. This mTOR pathway. So a drug called everolimus, or RAD-001, I think it's called Afinitor. It's approved in kidney cancer. It was looked at with tamoxifen or tamoxifen alone in patients with recurrent breast cancer that had already had an aromatase inhibitor. Their tumor was progressing. They were randomized to go on tamoxifen as the next step or tamoxifen plus this RAD-001 or everolimus. And the results were, it was a small study, it was randomized, though, that there was more clinical benefit, meaning the tumor at 6 months hadn't progressed or had responded, and a longer time until the tumor progressed, with this biologic being added to help overcome endocrine resistance. So stay tuned for more information on that. And then I'll end with one last study of another endocrine agent called fulvestrant or Faslodex, This study presented at San Antonio was called the FIRST study, and it was a study for newly relapsed metastatic breast cancer that was estrogen receptor positive. And they used this new higher dose of fulvestrant or Faslodex, which is an anti-estrogen that you get as a subcutaneous injection, versus anastrozole or arimidex. So it was a randomization to newly recurrent ER-positive breast cancer to the high-dose fulvestrant, which is its new approval, versus anastrozole. And in this study, what we saw was the fulvestrant appeared to be a winner. Now, we need further follow-up of this, but I mainly bring this up just to show that we've got three separate categories of anti-estrogen therapy. We've got tamoxifen's category called the SERMs. We've got the aromatase inhibitors, and we have this fulvestrant, which is in a class of pure antiestrogens that we call the SERDs. And plus, we're looking at adding new biologics in ER-positive breast cancer to our endocrine therapy to overcome resistance. So lots of excitement going on in that field.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grelo. Wonderful, wonderful introduction to this whole program and actually just wonderful information. So thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Eric Weiner. Dr. Weiner is Chief Division of Women's Cancers, Thompson Senior Investigator in Breast Cancer Research, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Chief Scientific Advisor, Susan G. Komen for The Cure. And Dr. Weiner is going to address HER2-positive breast cancer, and he's also going to address symptom management. Dr. Weiner?
Hi, well, thanks for having me. Julie and Lisa and I have done many things together over the years, and hopefully this will be useful to all of you who are listening. And as you know, after we finish talking, we're all going to be here to answer questions. So I just want to spend a few minutes talking about HER2-positive breast cancer, one of the subtypes that Julie mentioned, and one of the areas where there have been perhaps some of the most remarkable advances over the past 10 to 15 years, and then I'm going to talk briefly about symptom management. HER2-positive breast cancer is distinct from other breast cancer in that within the cancer cells there are too many copies of the so-called HER2 gene, and that means that too much HER2 protein is present on the surface of the cancer cell. And when it is there, it facilitates the cell's growth and its ability to spread and its ability to invade all things that are good for cancer cells and bad for people who have them. We've known for a long time that compared to some other types of breast cancer, HER2-positive breast cancer has the potential to be somewhat more rapidly growing and somewhat more aggressive. And that really changed, though, with the development of therapy that was targeted to HER2. The first therapy, as I think many of you know, probably all of you know, was the drug trastuzumab, commonly called Herceptin, which has now been commercially available for about 12 years. And I have to say that if you looked at the results from the initial trials with trastuzumab, when they were first presented in 1988 and 1999, I don't think anyone would have guessed that it would be a drug that would have such a profound impact both on the treatment of patients with metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer and for those women who have early-stage HER2-positive breast cancer. And it has truly changed the natural history of the illness in women with HER2-positive breast cancer. And as a result of Herceptin and drugs like Herceptin, women are living longer and women are living much better. Unlike many of the more traditional drugs that we have, drugs like hormonal therapies and chemotherapy, Herceptin appears to be a drug that even works after it stops working. And by that I mean that even when a woman's cancer gets worse on a Herceptin plus chemotherapy regimen, there's still evidence that she benefits from continuing with Herceptin in combination with other chemotherapy or sometimes hormonal therapy or sometimes other targeted therapy or other anti-HER2 therapy. In addition to Herceptin, there's the drug lapatinib or Tykerb, which works through a different mechanism but is also an anti-HER2 drug. Unlike Herceptin, it is an oral drug, and it has somewhat different side effects than Herceptin. And the fact that it's oral doesn't necessarily mean that it's easier to take or has fewer side effects. And if anything, I think most of us find that lapatinib has a few more side effects. But what we've learned is that lapatinib is a drug that when Herceptin stops working, can be effective when it's combined with other types of chemotherapy. And what we've also learned is that even when women have cancer that has gotten worse on Herceptin, that the combination of Herceptin plus lapatinib can be an effective therapy, more effective than lapatinib alone. And while I know that this is a call that's focused on the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, I think I'd be remiss to say or not to tell you about some excitement that there was at San Antonio about lapatinib in the setting of women with early stage breast cancer. And there, and this is relevant to women who have metastatic breast cancer, the excitement was about the combination of lapatinib and Herceptin. And what's important about this is that it looks like, at least for some women, that combinations of two anti-HER2 drugs may turn out to be better than one alone. This is not something that routinely should be put into practice at this point in time, certainly not for women with early-stage breast cancer and only selectively in women with metastatic breast cancer. But I think that it gives us some real hope for the future and not the very distant future, the near future. I want to mention three other drugs, and I must say that these drugs were only briefly covered at San Antonio, but they're three very important drugs. And they're drugs that you should watch in terms of the treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer. One of them is a drug called pertuzumab. Like Herceptin or trastuzumab, pertuzumab is another monoclonal antibody. It also hooks on to the HER2 receptor, although to a different place. And it works in a somewhat different way than Herceptin does. In fact, it seems to work best when it's combined with Herceptin, and the two drugs together seem to more effectively decrease the growth of cancer cells. It can be given in combination with Herceptin as a treatment in and of itself, meaning the two antibodies. And there are also studies looking at the combination of pertuzumab and trastuzumab in combination with chemotherapy, and we are now waiting for the results of a very large study that has been conducted in Europe in which women with metastatic breast cancer were randomized to receive either Herceptin plus chemotherapy or Herceptin plus chemotherapy plus the drug pertuzumab. And I think you're going to be hearing more about this drug in the future. The other drug that I want to mention is a drug called neratinib. Neratinib, like lapatinib, is an oral drug, and it's what's called a small molecule. It has a great deal of promise, and many think that it could turn out to be a better drug than lapatinib, although there can always be a downside, and the downside here is that it appears to cause somewhat more in the way of side effects than lapatinib. It, too, is being tested not so much in combination with Herceptin, but it is being compared to Herceptin in studies in combination with chemotherapy, and it's a drug you're going to be hearing more about. And finally, there's the drug that has perhaps received more attention than any other, and that is the drug that is called T-DM1, which stands for trastuzumab-DM1. DM1 is actually a form of chemotherapy, and in T-DM1, it is attached to trastuzumab, so it is an antibody-drug conjugate where the two molecules are actually linked to one another. The trastuzumab works by delivering the chemotherapy selectively to HER2-positive cancer cells. The chemotherapy and trastuzumab are brought inside the cell. The chemotherapy causes damage to the cell, And what's remarkable about it is that it seems to cause very little in the way of side effects or toxicity. This is a drug that has been evaluated in now 3 or 4 studies in women who have received many prior treatments for their HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. Unfortunately, it probably will not be approved for another year or 2 or 3. There had been hope that the U.S. FDA would consider an accelerated approval for the drug, but the FDA felt that the data were not sufficient for an accelerated approval. And it's a drug that I think most of us believe will almost certainly be approved at some point in time within the next few years. And I personally believe it's one of the most exciting drugs that we've all worked with in a long time to come. And it's exciting both because it's highly effective and because it has such a favorable side effect profile. It really is a drug that a woman can take and function in an entirely normal manner. There are a whole range of other drugs that are being tested for women with HER2-positive breast cancer. Some of these drugs will be given in combination with drugs like Herceptin and Lapatinib. Some of them will be given in combination with chemotherapy. And I think that there is a time that's coming in the not-distant future where we will have truly all the drugs we need for the treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer, recognizing that that's going to be a relatively large number of drugs we'll need because different HER2-positive breast cancers behave differently in different women, but that we really will have the necessary arsenal to, I hope, in the not-so-distant future, be able to eliminate mortality from women with HER2-positive breast cancer. When that'll happen, I can't tell you for sure, but I think that it's very reasonable to expect that in the next 5 to 10 years, we will have all of those drugs available. Finally, just a few comments about symptom management. I think the most important comment here is that no matter where you are in the course of your illness, it's important to pay attention to symptoms. Pain is something that is never easy to tolerate. Sometimes people are concerned about treating their pain because they think that they will mask some sign and won't be able to follow their cancer. And I do my best to convince people that that's simply not the case, and that having pain is never a good thing, either for one physically or mentally. I think it becomes critical when you have cancer to try to minimize the kind of symptoms that you have so you can go on functioning with your daily life. Other side effects that we've been paying more and more attention to over the past few years, some of which we have good treatments for, some of which we don't, include neuropathy or problems related to numbness and tingling that arises from some of our chemotherapy agents, fatigue, which can be a big problem with some of our agents, and then with some of the medications we use, there can be both weight gain and weight loss, and there's been more and more attention paid over the last few years to diet and exercise and ways that we can really help improve the lives of women with metastatic breast cancer. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lisa. Thanks.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Weiner, for just a very informative, as always, presentation, and also for making the very complicated understandable to everybody here. So thank you. And our next speaker is Lisa Carey, Dr. Lisa Carey. Dr. Carey is the Richardson and Marilyn Jacobs Prayer Distinguished Professor of Breast Cancer Research. She's Medical Director, UNC Breast Center, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Carey is going to address triple-negative breast cancer. She's going to also address some healthcare disparity issues and the important role of clinical trials. I now turn the program over to Dr. Carey.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you, everyone, for participating in this. I've had the pleasure of going after Julie and Eric, who have obviously covered a good deal of very important information. I have the pleasure of talking about triple-negative breast cancer. You know, this is the third group of breast cancer patients who are identified by the proteins in or on their cancer cells that let us use targeted agents. So the triple-negative subset of breast cancers are those whose tumors do not have either hormone receptors or HER2. So anti-estrogen or endocrine therapy, like Julie was talking about, are not effective, nor is HER2 targeting therapy. That means that the mainstay of treatment for triple-negative breast cancer has been chemotherapy. That said, the women with triple-negative breast cancer have actually benefited substantially, as much if not more than other subsets of breast cancers, from advances in chemotherapy and the fact that we now have a number of well-tolerated agents that can be used. I think the sort of the focus on chemotherapy is quite appropriate here, but I must say that at San Antonio and at other meetings over the course of the last couple of years, it's become increasingly clear that drugs that work in breast cancer tend to also work in triple-negative breast cancer, and in particular chemotherapy drugs, cytotoxic chemotherapy. An example that was presented at San Antonio was actually an examination of the drug capecitabine, or Xeloda. So, you know, every drug has sort of its real name and its drug company name. So this would be Xeloda, which in the study that was presented, it was a mature analysis of a examination of incorporating Xeloda or capecitabine into standard anthracycline taxane regular chemotherapy, that had found an improvement in early breast cancer with the incorporation of this drug, but when they looked at the triple negative subset, that was even augmented. One of the things that's important about triple negative breast cancer is that it is defined by not having hormone receptors like ER or PR or HER2, but if you look at it on a molecular level, there are certain molecular characteristics that are really very interesting about this subset of breast cancer. The first is that it's mostly made up of a subtype called the basal-like breast cancer subtype, and that's important for some targeted agents that I'm going to talk about in a minute. But one of the hallmarks of these breast cancers is that they're very proliferative, and I think one of the things that strikes me is that very proliferative tumors, particularly those where that's a fundamental nature of the cancer, have a tendency to, in fact, be sensitive to drugs that affect fast-growing and highly proliferative cells. So there may be a reason that we're seeing this impact, you know, kind of across the board with chemotherapy drugs. I think the idea of relying entirely on chemo is one that we'd like to get away from. I personally think that it's a very important endpoint to develop chemotherapies that are well tolerated and can be given for a long time, but I also would like to know about targeted agents that might be useful in this one subset of breast cancers that don't have a targeted agent. And there have been several trials trying to look at whether going after EGFR, which is a relative of HER2, it's also known as HER1, and it is a target that's used in other tumor types like lung cancer and colon cancer, but it has never been particularly useful in breast cancer to use drugs that target EGFR. There was a study presented at San Antonio by Dr. Jose Baselga that was an interesting study where they took chemotherapy alone with a platinum drug, with or without an EGFR inhibitor, and they did find that adding the EGFR inhibitor to the chemotherapy seemed to improve the response rate, so the tumor shrank more, and it did improve the time that the patients could stay on that therapy without the cancer growing again, what's called the progression-free survival. While it was, an important finding, it seemed to impact a relatively small number of patients with triple-negative breast cancer. And so while I'm intrigued by anything that suggests that we can target an Achilles heel and find an Achilles heel of triple-negative breast cancer, I think EGFR inhibition, while it looked like it did have an effect in some of these triple negatives, it wasn't a big enough effect that I would recommend it as a way to go forward in this subgroup in general. But I do think one of our challenges is maybe trying to figure out ways to identify those tumors in whom this would be the right way to go forward, and that's a challenge for our scientist collaborators. I do, as we kind of think about other targeted treatments, and this was not presented at San Antonio, but it's very timely right now, because there is a class of drugs that appear to maybe be a way forward in triple-negative breast cancer, and these are called PARP inhibitors. PARP inhibitors are a very interesting class of drugs because they're totally new. This is a new approach to treating cancers in general, not just breast cancers, in that these drugs actually target the ability of the cell to repair itself. And if we think about one of the ways that chemotherapy works is by kind of smacking the cancer, knocking it down. And one of the things that cancer cells are very good at is picking themselves up, dusting themselves off, and moving on. PARP inhibitors basically knock them back down and keep them down. So they add to the effectiveness of chemotherapy. And there was an important study that was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine, within the last week, that looked at the addition of a drug that is thought to be a PARP inhibitor called Iniparib. It doesn't have a drug company name yet beyond that. Added to chemotherapy, that found that in triple negative breast cancer, adding this drug to chemotherapy seemed to allow the patients to stay on the chemotherapy for longer, and they in fact did live longer. So I think this is a direction that may be particularly important for our breast cancer patients. It may be just for triple negative breast cancer. It may be for, other kinds of breast cancer. Those are trials that are ongoing now and that I think will help us identify in the future. The reason that this drug was given to triple negative breast cancers is because those cancers seem to be particularly prone to being knocked down by DNA damaging chemotherapy drugs. So I think one question that faces us is how important is the chemo in this whole paradigm, or whether the other drugs may be able to be tweaked in order to work all by themselves. But I do think this is one of the first real pieces of evidence that there's an Achilles heel in triple negative breast cancer that's a big enough Achilles heel that we can target it by just choosing triple negatives and giving one additional drug to chemotherapy and helping women with this disease. I wanted to talk about disparities because it's actually sort of difficult to talk about triple negative breast cancer without introducing, the fact that triple negative breast cancer does not affect all women equally. In fact, it is much more common in women who are young and women of color, particularly African or African American women, and this has become increasingly clear over time. Because of that, the things that affect triple negative breast cancer may be particularly relevant for, breast cancer in African American women in particular, in whom there is a difference in outcome that's been well documented over many years, and that in truth probably relates partly to biology, the fact that they have more of the triple negative subset, but also probably related to access to care and treatment differences. There's been a couple of studies recently that actually shed a little more light on this. The first report of the triple negative breast cancer being more common in African American women actually came from a study from my own state, from UNC, called the Carolina Breast Cancer Study, which was a population-based study across a large part of the eastern part of the state, and did find that triple negative affected about twice as many of the young African American women as everybody else. In a follow-up study, they looked at how knowing about the subtype, triple negative, for example, or hormone receptor positive or HER2 positive, how that impacted on the survival that women had from breast cancer. And they found, and this was just published within the last month or two, they found that if you just looked within triple negative or within hormone receptor positive or within HER2 positive, in fact, differences by race persisted. So although it was true that triple negative had a different outcome than hormone receptor positive, for example, if you just looked within triple negative, the African American women with the disease, in fact, still had additional survival implications, which means that, again, it's a far more complicated thing than just triple negative or hormone receptor positive or any other subtype, and that we have to think hard about access to care and the social elements here. There was a presentation at San Antonio of a study out of Detroit that actually looked at where patients were getting their care and did suggest that African American women were less likely than white women to go to a high quality or a high volume hospital, and that may have implications for the kind of therapy that they had access to. And it was interesting. They looked and they found it was not because of transportation, and it didn't seem to be because of geography. So even though they were actually living closer to these hospitals, they didn't seem to be being seen there. So that's a, you know, the reasons for that needs to be teased out, and I think brings us back to the important social elements for how care is administered here. And I think the last thing I wanted to close with is this, the crucial importance of these kind of trials and the things that all three of us have been talking about in how we move forward. Everything that I do in the clinic really depends on the women who are kind enough to participate in the clinical trials that were done over many years to inform how we treat patients today. And I always tell patients when I'm treating them that, you know, we all learn from the women who have participated in these trials and given us the information that lets us set a new standard. So we have the standard of 2011, and I want the standard of 2012 and 2013 and 2020 to be better than the standard of 2011. And the only way we can get there is by participating in clinical trials, which I think, to be honest, I think my patients are often get there in advance of all of us, this is something that women understand, and there's a reason that the breast cancer community has been so proactive in moving things forward for all of us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carey. Really exceptional presentation. Thank you so much, and for covering such a variety of topics so well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Patricia Spicer. Pat is an oncology social worker. She's breast cancer program coordinator for cancer care. And Pat's going to go over with you some of the services that you can access from cancer care. Pat.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. I'm always amazed after San Antonio in December about how much research is going on all over the world to help women with breast cancer. And at Cancer Care, we would like to help, too. If you or if a loved one has been diagnosed with breast cancer, please feel free to contact us. We provide services from oncology social workers, and it includes individual counseling, support groups, education, financial assistance, and referrals. If you'd like to learn more about our services, please call us at 1-800-813-HOPELINE or 4673, or visit us online at www.cancercare.org. And I'd also like to add how important it is those women who have offered to be part of the clinical trials and the advances that they have helped create with their participation. A big round of applause to all of you. I know there are lots of questions, so I'll stop now and allow people to ask their questions. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, for really explaining to everybody how to access our services. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board. And if, Mary, would you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions? And we will take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and we will address your questions. But we're going to see if we can take as many as possible. And we have great speakers, so I think we can do it. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Joan N.
Yes, in New York City. This is a question about the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib. Is that accepted by the NCCN? Guidelines, is that listed in those guidelines? And if not, would it be possible to list it if you feel that there's benefit?
Well, thank you. Excellent question. Dr. Weiner, could you address that?
I actually don't know if it's listed. I have a feeling that it is. Julie or Lisa, do you happen to know? We can look it up. Either of you know?
I don't know for sure.
I'm more than happy to look it up while someone else asks a question and report back a little later. Okay. I don't know that I have a way of getting it listed, but it is not an FDA approved regimen for women with metastatic breast cancer, but it is certainly a regimen that some physicians give, and to my knowledge, there has not been difficulty getting coverage for it from insurance.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for that question, Joan. And our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Margie G.
Hi. I have a question about Herceptin once chemotherapy has ended. Are any of the doctors recommending starting an aromatase inhibitor at the same time as Herceptin is being given during the year recommended after chemotherapy is completed?
So if in fact you're talking about giving a course of chemotherapy followed by Herceptin, which is typically given for a total of a year, for somebody with breast cancer who has had surgery and is then hoping to be off Herceptin for the rest of her life, and you're asking whether an aromatase inhibitor could be given concurrently, which would then be continued for a period presumably of 5 years, most people would start the aromatase inhibitor after completing the chemotherapy but during the Herceptin, and that's what was done in the large adjuvant trials. In somebody with metastatic breast cancer, we often will give a course of chemotherapy and Herceptin, and after a woman has had improvement with that combination, we'll simply continue Herceptin alone. If the cancer is estrogen receptor positive, some doctors might start an aromatase inhibitor at that point in time. Others might just leave a woman on Herceptin and use the aromatase inhibitor at some point in the future when there's evidence that the cancer is somewhat worse.
Well, I might, add that another possibility is to, use the anti-estrogen therapy in a different kind of HER2-targeted therapy. So in some cases, women with metastatic disease end up on lapatinib, the drug that Eric was commenting on before. So there's a number of different ways to approach a person who has both HER2-positive and hormone receptor-positive disease.
Great.
Excellent. Okay. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Diana E.
This is a question for Dr. Perry. Are there trials of PARP inhibitors for ER-positive breast cancer for which hormone treatments have lost their effectiveness, so those patients are just on chemo now?
Yeah, there are a number of PARP inhibitor trials that are either open or getting started, and whether or not a PARP inhibitor can augment chemotherapy effectiveness in ER-positive breast cancer or augment hormone, anti-hormone type approaches is a big question. I have to say it's easier to see how it might work in combination with chemotherapy than with anti-estrogen or endocrine therapies. But the fact is that we don't really know exactly how these drugs work that well yet. So I know there are trials that are in the process of being opened for ER-positive breast cancer, but they're patients who are being treated with chemotherapy. I am not aware of any where it's being combined with endocrine therapy with either any of the PARP inhibitors, and there are a number of them being developed right now. But it wouldn't surprise me if coming down the pike there were some, and either Julia or either Dr. Weiner or Dr. Grelo may know of some that I don't know about.
Yeah, so I think she asked about when endocrine therapy isn't working anymore. So that would tie into the chemo. We would think that if there is a role in ER-positive, it would probably be augmenting the impact of chemo. I'm the international PI on a trial that we think we're having the investigator meeting at the end of February, so we hope we'll be open very soon, using the exact same chemotherapy, gemcitabine and carboplatin, that was used in triple-negative breast cancer, using that in ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer after progression on standard endocrine therapies and a randomization to the PARP inhibitor Iniparib that we've been talking about. We're wondering if even within ER-positive breast cancer there aren't these subsets, and our hypothesis is that if it works, it would be in maybe a subset that we're now, Lisa and Eric are experts in this as well, what we call the luminal B, or kind of the more aggressive estrogen receptor positive subset. So we'll be carefully looking at that in any trials of chemo with PARP inhibitors and estrogen receptor positive, subsetting the ER positives even, to see if there's a subset of the ER positives that might benefit.
Carolyn, also, if the caller is interested in looking or helping or have a search for clinical trials by contacting Emerging Med at www.emergingmed.org. They will assist you in looking for trials that may be applicable to your circumstances.
And we also, of course, in your materials, we have also the National Cancer Institute, cancer.gov, is also a wonderful site as well in terms of getting help in terms of searching for trials. I actually want to just say that this past discussion that just occurred between all of our speakers, it really demonstrates for all of you how often physicians work together collaboratively. I wonder if Dr. Grelo, Dr. Weiner, and Dr. Carey just want to say a word about this collaborative. I think often it's not something that everyone has a chance to witness in action, and I just wondered if you could comment on just on how that works for each of you, because I see you all doing it when we work together, but often people don't realize that their physicians are working together in this way or what those dialogues are like.
Sure. Go ahead, one of you. No. I was just going to say, we all work together extensively, and I think that it's not just a matter of clinicians and clinical researchers working together. It's more and more clinical researchers and lab-based researchers working together, since I think we all believe that it's going to take the two groups coming together, along with many others, people like computational biologists and statisticians and a whole range of other disciplines, to really find answers and identify new treatments. So, there's more collaboration than there was ever before. Of course, there are still, the usual set of interpersonal struggles that happen when you bring people together, and occasional political challenges, but I think that there's a real sense that this is a team effort.
And we don't have right or wrong ways to treat metastatic breast cancer. I think you've heard some of that. We have lots of options. In some ways, we can tailor them to tumor factors and patient goals, but lots of times there's no one right way. So we try to tailor our recommendations, but lots of times we're getting input from our colleagues. I live in the greater Seattle area, and I talk to my colleagues in the Pacific Northwest about different patients' difficult cases. I think Lisa and Eric and I will run some difficult cases by each other just to get a sense of, what would we do, since there isn't any therapy in metastatic breast cancer that is 100% effective with 100% without toxicity. Until we get to that point, I think there's lots of options, and we all are always learning, and that's why we're talking about the San Antonio conference. How did that change things? But we'll have our next conference, next month, and we're always looking for new and better ways in terms of efficacy and toxicities in helping our patients.
I think I'd only echo what Julian and Eric have just said, in that we do talk to each other a lot. My husband calls us the Groundhog Day people, because we're always together. And one of the things I know my patients have found very reassuring is the fact that a lot of oncologists around the country actually communicate frequently with each other. So that if you come to see me, and I'm not sure of the right thing to do, it is my habit to send out, emails or just call my friends, including the two other people on this call, to say, well, what would you do in these circumstances? So, I think if people knew how much that happened, they would find it reassuring that, in fact, people do, you get virtual tumor boards a fair amount on complicated cases.
Incredibly reassuring. Thank you so much, and excellent. Thank you for highlighting this. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sherry T.
Yes, I was wondering what the early symptoms might be of metastatic brain cancer.
Dr. Weiner, would you take that one?
Sure. particularly for patients who have HER2-positive and triple-negative breast cancer, cancer spreading to the brain is something that does occur. It doesn't occur in the majority of women, but it occurs in a sizable minority of women over the course of their illness. And thankfully, it's something that can be usually treated quite effectively. The symptoms that people will often develop, probably the most important and the most frequent, is headache. And it is often a headache that is worse when a woman gets up in the morning or when she's lying down. And beyond headache, really anything that suggests a neurologic source. So weakness or numbness in a leg or an arm, difficulty seeing, anything of that sort could be a sign that there could be cancer that has spread to the brain, and that's something that's obviously requires a call to your doctor or healthcare team.
Excellent question, and thank you. I hope that helps you in terms of an answer, and I hope you'll be aware of these symptoms to bring them to your physicians and if you have any questions. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Penny W.
Yes, this sounds kind of probably stupid, but I'm
No stupid questions on this call, though. Any question is fine.
I'm beginning to think, since I'm metastatic, that all of a sudden I've discovered we're kind of the stepchildren of the breast cancer, you know, rah-rah. You know, they don't realize that we're the ones that die of all this stuff. Do you feel that enough is being researched and everything's being done that can be done? Shouldn't it be more brought out in the open that this is something that really needs research and everything done on it, you know, to save everybody?
So excellent question, and I'm going to ask all our speakers to really address this. I'm going to ask Dr. Grelo to start with the first comment.
I think that I understand where you're coming from, and a lot of what we talked about was taking earlier stage breast cancer and translating information there into the metastatic setting. But I would say that is actually an unusual situation. Most new drugs, and we have lots of exciting new drugs, are first studied in the metastatic setting, we find a role there if they work. If they don't, we get rid of them and focus on more important things. And then we look at them in the earlier stage setting. I'll point out, just in November of last year, we had two new drugs approved in the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, one being eribulin, which is a new chemotherapy agent for women who have already had lots of prior chemotherapy in the metastatic setting, and this drug showed response and actually survival benefit. The other drug was a drug called denosumab, or Xgeva, which is a drug to treat bone metastases in breast cancer as well as other solid tumors. And so I throw these out as examples of that there is hope. There are new drugs that are becoming options. And a lot of what we're doing, the majority of the studies at my institution that are open are for metastatic patients. And I don't think that was reflected well in what was presented at San Antonio. But we're doing a lot of work there. And we know that women are dying every day of metastatic breast cancer. And we've got to get better treatments and better options for those women.
I'd just like to comment also that in the advocacy setting that there is a greater awareness of the fact that women with metastatic disease have different issues and different needs than the woman with early stage breast cancer, and that we have been working to develop better educational materials and to be more sensitive to what the issues that these women are dealing with. Not just about pink ribbons, but about the fact that these women are at a very different place and have special needs, and we do want to address them.
Thank you, Pat. And Dr. Weiner?
You know, I think that some of what you're reacting to is the emotional part of it. And I think that for many reasons, women with metastatic breast cancer are the people that women with early stage breast cancer don't want to think about, because it's hard not to think about it and feel threatened. And I would agree with you that, you know, we need to make sure that there is adequate attention paid to the community of women who have metastatic breast cancer. This is what takes women's, what takes the lives of women with breast cancer. As Julie said, there's a great deal of research going on in that setting. I think that none of us would ever say that there's enough research going on. We'd like to see more funds devoted to breast cancer research. And I think that, again, what you're feeling is something that, that many have been talking about recently.
Thank you for bringing up this important point. And Dr. Carey, would you like to comment as well?
Yeah, I have to say, I think there's a couple of things going on. I think what Eric and Julie have commented on is 100% correct. And I'd like to take it one step further by saying, I think this is one of those places where there's a bit of a disconnect between what's actually happening in terms of research and clinical care and what gets reported in terms of showing up in the newspaper. As Julie said, everything we do, every drug that I use, I can't think of one where it didn't start by showing some element of effectiveness in the metastatic setting. It's almost the denominator from which we then try and move drugs forward into improving the cure rate. But in truth, it is used. This is where we start. As a community, there's an enormous amount of research being done into finding not only new drugs and new combinations of drugs, but also figuring out more tolerable and effective ways of giving the older drugs. Those aren't particularly sexy, though, in terms of they make a big difference for me and for my patients, but they're not necessarily something that the New York Times wants to write about. So I'm not sure that it's part of this, and I think there's a lot of elements here that play into that perception, but I think part of it may be that a lot of the work that's being done is being done a little bit under the radar, and it's coming out in actual treatment advances and paradigm shifts, but it's not being talked about as much publicly.
So I think I really want to thank our last questioner for that wonderful, our last caller for that wonderful actually comment and question. I think it is really a call to action for this. Here we are doing this program today, but obviously what we're hearing is that there is a lot being done, and, of course, everyone is saying we would like to even do more and much more. And I know all of you in the audience would like more to be done as well. And I think what Pat has said is that we're trying to develop new models of being of health as well, but also you really want new treatments and new options to be able to hear about. So we definitely have our work cut out for us. There's no question about it. I think the speakers we have today are very committed to this area, so I hope you got that sense. But I think we all do agree that we'd like to be able to report more in future calls that would give you more information as well as more information is established. I want to thank our speakers today. They've really been extraordinary, and extraordinary in many ways. I want to thank all of you who asked such really terrific questions, because your questions really helped us to really further elaborate on points that were important to all of you. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that we do not meet all of your needs in that 1 hour, that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So if we didn't get your question, please do call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. But also, we have many services that we offer. So although our program will soon be over, the hour will soon be up, our services from Cancer Care, those continue, and those are available to you, from Cancer Care every day. So please be aware that we do offer practical and financial assistance. We have a copay foundation. We also do provide individual and group counseling, and that group counseling can be over the phone, or it can be online, and the same is true for individual counseling. And we have all sorts of materials we can send to you and booklets. And, of course, we do also offer many other workshops, many other teleconferences. Indeed, we do have a program on February 11th on caring for your bones when you have breast cancer, what's new, which may be of interest to some of you as well. And so there's lots of programs coming up that you have in the calendar. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I wouldn't want anyone to feel that you're alone. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are here for you. And call us whenever you feel you need help with any issue that you're dealing with. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.